This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening here on a nice fall evening in Houston, Texas. This evening on Queer Voices, we're going to be talking to Matt Foreman, who's the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, talking about the No Nonsense Campaign and the Creating Change Conference coming up. Also, we'll be talking to the people from Lazarus House about the upcoming Halloween Haunted House. In the second hour, we're going to be talking to people from Stages, Pat Gandy about the Lesbian Health Fair, and some transgendered issues. But first, before that, we go to London and the BBC World News.
BBC News with Joan Jason. Aid workers in Kashmir say winter weather and untreated injuries could cause another wave of deaths in the earthquake-hit region. An estimated 60,000 people in Pakistani-administered Kashmir were injured in the earthquake 10 days ago, and relief workers fear many are still cut off in mountainous terrain with no medical help. The United Nations says more than 3 million people have been left homeless, and the Pakistani government says it needs another 500,000 tents capable of withstanding winter conditions. Mike Wooldridge reports from Muzaffarabad.
The helicopters may have been shuttling in and out of this devastated region non-stop once again after the weekend's disruptions because of bad weather, but this brought no apparent respite yet for the people of Butnara, 2,500 meters up in the mountains. Village leaders have now walked the 50 kilometers to Muzaffarabad to urge the army to try to put a helicopter down near Butnara to bring medical help for more than 50 people injured in the earthquake and tents and fodder for their cattle. The reality is that so many people have been affected by the earthquake that the logistical challenges of the relief operation are becoming more daunting with time.
The British charity Oxfam has accused governments of failing to react effectively to humanitarian emergencies. In a report on disasters, Oxfam says humanitarian assistance often arrives too late, is inadequate, and is too often a response to media coverage rather than actual need. David Loyne reports.
In a year which has seen the Asian tsunami, the inundation of New Orleans, mudslides in Guatemala, and now the South Asian earthquake, the Oxfam report says that 2005 is part of a worsening trend. Not only have there been more natural disasters in the last 5 years than previously, but they have affected far more people, particularly in poor countries. Oxfam are now supporting a British government attempt to get support for a $1 billion a year fund to deal with emergencies.
The Independent Electoral Commission in Iraq says it is re-examining ballots from Saturday's referendum because the figures provided by most provinces were unusually high. The commission said the numbers, which correspondents say relate to turnout, were higher than normal international averages. The commission said the final result could be delayed by several days while the voting was verified. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The World Health Organization has warned the public against panic buying of an antiviral drug which reduces the severity of the human form of bird flu. With cases of the most severe strain of the disease now confirmed in birds in Europe, the organization has stressed that the drug Tamiflu can only be used to treat people who've caught the virus already. Dr. Mike Ryan, head of the WHO's Pandemic Alert Unit, says the drug could be essential in containing an outbreak.
WHO has put in place a stockpile that we are using for public health purposes, and that means that we believe that there may be a small window of opportunity as the pandemic virus emerges. If we detect it quick enough, we might be able to go in there and saturate a whole area with antivirals and be able to slow down, if not stop, the emergence of the pandemic strain. But the antivirals are not a golden bullet solution. It's not a solution. It's part of a more complex solution.
The United States Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is traveling to China for his first visit there since he took office in 2001. Mr. Rumsfeld is due to meet his Chinese counterpart as well as President Hu Jintao to discuss ways of improving communication between U.S. and Chinese armed forces. The authorities in Uganda have agreed to hold a state funeral for the country's former president Milton Obote after arguments over whether he should be given such an honour. Mr. Obote died last week of kidney failure, aged 80. His body is due to be flown to Uganda from Zambia, where he lived as an exile for 20 years. Will Ross reports from Kampala.
There was little love lost between Milton Obote and the current Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni. The war during the 1980s between Yoweri Museveni's rebel forces and the then President Milton Obote's National Army left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead. For two decades, attempts at reconciliation between the two men failed. It has been suggested that regional leaders may have played a role in persuading the Ugandan government to honour Milton Obote because of the support he offered during the 1960s to exiled South Africans fighting against white minority rule.
Ukrainian police have detained the Azerbaijani opposition leader Rasul Guliyev after his plane was diverted to Ukraine as he was returning home from exile. Ukrainian officials said Mr. Guliyev was detained on an international arrest warrant and was being questioned at a police station in Crimea. Mr. Guliyev is accused in Azerbaijan of embezzling public money while he was in government in the 1990s, a charge he denies. BBC News.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Belinsky.
And J.D. Doyle.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And we're all here this evening for Queer Voices, all of us. Well, except Joan. Joan is not here, and she's not on the line.
Except that, you know, I mean, it may not be on your radar screen, Jack, but for a lot of people, we don't even exist tonight because there's a ball game going at Minute Maid Park.
True.
Or like they call it, the juice box.
I don't follow basketball.
Yes.
I try to avoid all of those sports things.
I'm a total news junkie, and I went to Minneapolis this weekend for the Pride Conference, the Interpride Conference. It was just a fabulous conference. But knowing that, I did know that game was going on the other night, and me and one of the other people from Houston were talking about what was the score, because, you know, normally we wouldn't do it because it's so blasted on the media, or normally we don't even care. But this evening, we actually have a very full show tonight. We're going to be talking to Matt Foreman shortly from the National Gay Lesbian Task Force. And, Deborah, we have some other guests tonight, too, don't we?
Yes, Danielle Sampay, the executive director of the Lazarus House, is going to talk about their upcoming Halloween haunted house. It's a fundraiser for them. And then J.D. has a very special interview.
There's a new show starting at Stages this coming week, and I think we had the first interview with the folks to talk about it. It's been described as equal parts William Shakespeare and Monty Python. That should be intriguing.
Yeah, it does sound interesting.
And then Pat Gandy will be on talking about the Lesbian Health Fair.
And then Jennifer Renee Poole will be coming on talking about coming out transgendered. Last week we talked about the coming out day, and we pretty much covered the gamut except for the transgendered community, so we thought we'd have a little chat about that.
And plus we have This Way Out, including News Wrap and some of the other segments that is just such a great show. But first up,
Matt Foreman, are you with us? Well, sounds like he's not. Glenn still got him on hold. Let's see. Are we doing hand signals? Are we... Hello? Earth to Glenn. Come in, Glenn.
Well, he was there.
There's another line flashing, so
yeah,
he's
he may
trying
have dropped
to come
off
back
and maybe
on.
Try
okay,
to call
well,
back in.
Glenn will try to get that working.
We'll get Matt on the line and then be talking to him. We're going to talk about the No Nonsense in November campaign, which is a big part of this election cycle coming up. And also, every November, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force has the Creating Change Conference, which, Jack, you've been to some of them, I know.
I've been to a couple of them, and they've been fabulous, although I haven't been to one in a while.
Yeah, they're usually the same weekend as Veterans Day weekend, and I like to go to them when I can. Okay, we're going to try it now, I think.
Just give him a second.
Okay, he's still pushing buttons.
Right, and where is it this year?
Oh, it's going to be in Oakland. It's been in Oakland, California before, and they liked it so much they went there again.
Actually, J.D., I think, warned me that there was an SBC truck out in the outside the building, which is always a bad sign. Okay.
Matt, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. I think we were having a little bit of technical difficulties there.
Yeah, Pat may actually get cut off while we're doing this because they are working on the phone lines right now.
I see.
Okay, well, let's
talk fast.
We just spent the time discussing about the Astros being in the playoffs, you know, big, important queer news like that. So, Matt?
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the part that it's playing in the fight against Proposition 2 here in Texas with the No Nonsense in November campaign.
Okay.
So
happy to do that. We have been involved in training folks in Houston to go door-to-door and talk to their neighbors and voters about why this proposition is a very bad thing for Texas families, for gay people, and why they should vote against it. We also developed a series of television ads that have been running over the last week in Houston.
Yes, and they're excellent. I happened to see the one with my friends Carolyn Mobley and Adrian Bowie, and I was very impressed. Tell me, how did that come about, creating those ads?
Well, we felt that a new approach needed to be taken in talking to voters about marriage, that in the past we've had 19 consecutive statewide votes on anti-marriage constitutional amendments, and virtually every campaign has used the same message along the lines that it's wrong to write discrimination in the Constitution or that the measures go too far. And not a single television ad that's ever been run opposing these amendments has ever featured a gay or lesbian couple speaking about marriage. And we thought it was time to really try ads that spoke honestly about why marriage matters to gay people, and not to try to dodge the issue and not to try to talk around it, but to really have real people talking about their lives and their love. And that's how these came about.
And there's a wonderful tagline that says, "How would you feel if you could not marry the person you love?" And that just, like, hones in on what it's really all about, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I think that marriage is an extremely difficult issue to reach voters on because most people, most straight people, really don't think about marriage. It's kind of like the air you breathe. People know it's there, but they really don't know what it's comprised of. They never think about it. So our feeling is that if we're going to fight these very ugly initiatives, that we should at least be honest. And in the process, if we can't do anything, if we can't change a vote, at least we can make people feel guilty about voting against us.
Make them feel guilty. That's always a tactic.
Well, you know, I think that we've got to elevate marriage beyond rights and responsibilities. We have to make people understand that when they're voting for one of these propositions, they are saying to us that gay people are less than human. It's not about a package of rights. It's not about a better dental plan. It's that, are we fully human and therefore entitled to what straight people have, or aren't we? And, you know, people can dodge and say, oh, the Bible tells me so, or this is tradition, or whatever excuse they want to bring up. The bottom line is that if people vote for these amendments, they don't think we're fully human. And I think we have to elevate this to a moral plane, not a 1,138 rights and responsibilities. This is really about whether we're human or not.
I agree with you totally on that because, for one thing, we already have laws on the books here in Texas that say two people of the same sex can't get married. And this amendment, however it's voted on, won't change that. We still won't be able to get married in the state of Texas until maybe some other changes take place. But it sends this message that we're not entitled to full civil rights as other classes of people are. And so I really appreciate seeing that. But I also think in looking at our relationships as being equal to or just as valid is an important aspect, sometimes within our own community.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of gay people, myself included, that are ambivalent about the institution of marriage. It comes with a lot of baggage. But the reality is that marriage, particularly for people that don't have money, is the only way that you can access rights, responsibilities, protections, you know, if you've got money, you can hire a lawyer and you can try to approximate some of the things that come with marriage. But if you don't have money, which is the most of us, there's no other way to do it. And there's something more about marriage. Marriage, you know, for straight people, they don't think when they're getting married, oh, I'm going to get this right and this responsibility. People generally get married because they love one another and they want to stand in front of their community and pledge their love to each other in front of their family, their community. And so marriage has, you know, it's more than rights, but it has this very strong social, emotional construct that lots of gay people and lots of lesbian people and bisexual and transgender people, they want the same thing. And so to me, I think about it a little bit like HIV. When HIV and AIDS were devastating the gay male community, lesbians could have said, you know what, this isn't our, it's not affecting us. I'm not going to fight against it. I'm not going to help you out. They didn't do that. Praise the Lord. Lesbians stood up. They fought beside us. They were instrumental in making the advances that we have made against HIV in this country. It's kind of the same thing. Not everyone in our community wants to get married. But those people that do, and they want, and they do want to do it intensely. I feel it's incumbent upon us, if community means anything, that we fight for those people's rights. And that, and just, it's not just as important, but as important that we stand up to these bigots who want to use marriage against us and for political ends.
From what you have heard about the campaign, where we are with it right now, what is your sense of it?
Well, my sense is that it's like everywhere else in the country where this has been fought. It's an uphill battle. If you put a basic human right up for a popular vote, you are swimming upstream. I would bet you that if a woman's right to choose was put on the ballot in Texas, we'd have a hard time holding on to it. And it's not even something that quote-unquote controversial. If freedom of assembly or freedom of religion or freedom of press were put on the ballot in Texas and most other states across this country, we probably wouldn't have them today. So people
right.
need to understand.
They did that experiment where they took the Bill of Rights and presented
right.
it to people and said, how would you feel about this? And they were against
that. Absolutely. And that's why we have a Bill of Rights, and our founders understood that those rights had to be in the Constitution because minorities could never win them through a popular vote. So what's the lay of the land? I think that Glenn Maxey and No Nonsense in November are doing a simply extraordinary job of fighting and raising the issue and pressing forward. At the same time, it is really hard. And our opponents have got resources vastly greater than ours. They have a way of manipulating and using churches for political purposes that's frankly not only immoral but illegal. And we don't have, and on our side, although there are strong straight allies that are standing up for us, straight people are not coming to our defense in the way that they ought to be standing up for us. If this was another minority under attack, if another minority was being told that they couldn't get married, trust me, churches, elected officials, the media would be up in arms. But because it happens to be about us queer folk, most of them are silent.
Mm-hmm. You said that this really isn't about the over 1,000 some odd dead roll protections that people are granted just by virtue of being able to marry, but to a certain extent, it is. And we have coming up here October 23rd at 2 p.m. in Spots Park an event called No Tragedy in November, an equality vigil. And we're going to have 1,138 people dressed in black wearing tragedy masks, and each one of them will be holding something that demonstrates what one of those protections or rights that are granted by marriage are. It's a demonstration to show that. We also have coming up this Tuesday, that would be tomorrow night, at 5:30 at the Absinthe, how do you say that word? I don't know that word. Absinthe? It's like in vodka, I think. Some kind of drink. Lounge. 609 Richmond Avenue at Greeley. A no-nonsense in November campaign fundraiser, which will feature our city controller, Anise Parker. We're trying to get the word out. I know our Houston Equal Rights Alliance folks have been out there doing that door-to-door work. And there is an interfaith group that is going to be meeting on October 27th to talk more about how communities of faith are coming together against Proposition 2. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, Matt, was the way the national organizations that we always think of as those folks inside the Beltway and the state level people as well as our local people are working together on this campaign. And while we in Houston will play a big role because we have some major city elections taking place, so we're likely to get more voters out, that there is this effort that may go well beyond whatever happens with the vote this November. Is that correct?
Well, it has to. I mean, yes, and I really want to applaud and urge everyone to come out to the events that you talked about earlier. I mean, Anise Parker is such a tremendous ally, and it sounds, however we can dramatize what this proposition is really all about, that's great. But ultimately, the cause for equality and the fight for civil rights is a really long-term struggle. And no matter what happens in November, the fight is going to go on, and it's going to go on for many years. Our opponents know that, and they've been really dug in and fighting for 40 years. And it's this isn't easy, as everyone knows, and it's not going to be quick. And if we look to other community struggles, I think we can honestly say that our community has made more progress in the 36 years since Stonewall than almost any other civil rights or human justice issue in the history of the world. So it feels like, you know, geez, we're stuck right now. We made a lot of progress. We just have to keep slugging away at it, and that means working together, as you said, federal, state, and local organizations. There can't be any divisions here.
Well, and I'm going to chime in a little bit here. I'm Jack Valinsky, and I'm part of the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. And the caucus, along with No Nonsense in November and HERA, the Houston Equal Rights Alliance, is working on a voter ID project. There's been a whole bunch of block walks on the weekends that a number of volunteers are doing. And this list is going to help us in the future. It's going to help us now, but it's going to help us in the future to get our people out to vote. And certainly, as we look for next year, there's certain state representative that we'd like to get out of office who had got this bill to be on the ballot this election.
That's great. I mean, that is actually the absolute only way that we are going to prevail. And that's how, you know, the other side in Texas and most parts of the country is not the majority. They have just done a much better job of organizing their people, identifying their people, and turning them out to vote. And so I want to applaud you and everyone who's doing that. It takes some gumption to get up and go door to door, but it's the way to build power, and it's actually the cheapest and most effective way to do it. So congratulations to you for doing that. That's wonderful.
Matt, thank you so much for being with us here on Queer Voices. And before I let you go, would you tell us just a little bit about the Creating Change Conference and how people can get connected to the task force?
The Creating Change Conference is the movement's, gay and lesbian movement's, annual national conference. This year it's going to be in Oakland in November 10th through 13th. You can go online at creatingchange.org. It has 300 workshops, pre-conference institutes on everything from aging to community centers to fighting racism. We have amazing plenaries coming up featuring people that are fighting the marriage fight in California, leaders in the labor movement, leaders in pro-gay religious communities. I mean, it's a simply extraordinary event. It has about 2,500 people, and it's if people want to feel involved and learn skills and get recharged and, you know, have a really good time, creating change is the place to be. So
It is. I've been to about seven of them, and they're fabulous.
Great.
I wish I could make it again this year, but it's just not going to happen. But
I'm sorry.
But it certainly is, of all the different kinds of conferences I've been to over the years, it is the premier, the quality of what is there and what you get out of it and what you can bring home and then use is just top rate. So I applaud the task force on its continuing work, and again, thank you for being with us this evening on Queer Voices.
It was quite an honor. Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. African Anglican angst advances unabated. A young Aussie couple fights to import their Canadian marriage. And the star of Capote rings true as the infamous author. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm John Beaupré.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 15th, 2005. How much more can tensions over lesbian, gay, and trans inclusion in the Anglican Church continue to rise before the schism pot boils over? The ordination of a British trans woman in late September certainly did nothing to cool the situation. Bishop of Hereford Anthony Pritis called Sarah Jones a person made by God, loved by God, and given gifts by God who feels that she's called to be a priest. And that's a call that's been checked out by the Church rigorously. The Evangelical Alliance, a conservative organization within the Church of England, called Pritis' position blasphemy. Just prior to the announcement of Jones' ordination, the Church of England's role as the mother church of the worldwide Anglican Communion had already been challenged. The Church of Nigeria, the second largest Anglican community, changed its constitution's references to communion with the See of Canterbury to instead affirm its ties with other churches based on the traditional faith, doctrine, sacrament, and discipline of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Nigerian Archbishop Peter Akinola, de facto leader of the conservative Global South contingent of African, Asian, and Latin American churches, insists that no actual split is in the offing, but describes their relationship with the Episcopal Church in the United States, the Church of Canada, and the Church of England as broken. Akinola says that a formal separation is not on the agenda when the Global South churches meet in Cairo later this month. The Church of Nigeria's idea of creating some distance from the Church of England may be catching on, however, as a proposal to similarly amend the Australian Church's constitution is being proposed at the upcoming annual synod of the Sydney Diocese. Sydney Anglicans will also discuss protocols for taking in like-minded Bible-based churches, including uniting church congregations alienated by that denomination's tensions over LGBT issues.
Akinola's unwanted colleague, the once unfailingly optimistic New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson, has his doubts about the future of the Anglican Communion. It was Robinson's consecration as the first openly gay Episcopal bishop, as well as the Church of Canada's acceptance of the blessings of same-gender couples, that prompted the revolt of Anglican conservatives. In a recent Associated Press interview, Robinson said the uproar is as much about power and control as it is about theology and scripture. It's about who's going to be calling the shots and who's going to be in and who's going to be out. For signs of the deepening divide, Robinson only has to look to his neighboring state of Connecticut, where six parishes have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Bishop Andrew Smith. The six plaintiff priests have sought to be supervised by another bishop because of Smith's support for Robinson, and now allege that Smith wrongfully disciplined them without due process. Meanwhile, a newly published book promises to add more fuel to the fire. Gays and the Future of Anglicanism features the arguments of 22 two leading theologians opposing the moratorium on gay consecrations and same gender blessings recommended by the Church's Windsor Report last year. According to Archbishop of Wales Dr. Barry Morgan, who himself participated in writing the Windsor Report, the book shows up the superficiality of previous Anglican discussions of the subject. Morgan says the views expressed should give the Anglican Church in many places cause for penitence for the way it has treated and thought about gay people.
In heavily Catholic Spain, a judge in the capital city of Madrid has ruled that people in same-gender marriages, which were legalized in that country in July, are entitled to the same survivor's pensions as those in traditional heterosexual marriages. The case involved a gay man who married shortly after Spain legalized same-gender unions, but whose male spouse died a month later. The court instructed the government to provide the pension in accordance with the new law, but the conservative opposition party has denounced the law and asked the Constitutional Court to declare it void under Spain's constitution. The party has been split by the controversy, however, especially now that some 60% of the electorate, according to a recent poll, have voiced opposition to conservative efforts to strip gays and lesbians of their equal rights to marriage.
Neither gay and lesbian nor conservative activists really know what to make of Harriet Myers, U.S. President George W. Bush's second nominee for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, but religious right leader James Dobson thinks he might. Dobson's comment about White House assurances as to her anti-abortion position, broadcast on his Focus on the Family program, have prompted Republican Senate Judiciary Chair Arlen Specter to publicly consider calling the anti-gay minister to testify before the committee during Myers' confirmation hearings. Meanwhile, queer advocacy groups are reflecting on Myers' responses to a 1989 candidate survey by the Lesbian Gay Coalition of Dallas when she ran for city council there. At the time, Myers told the group she supported civil rights for lesbians and gay men, but that she would not support an effort to repeal the Texas sodomy law, which was ultimately struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2003. Myers did not seek and did not receive the Dallas Coalition's endorsement, but members were still somewhat encouraged by her willingness to engage them at all and her subsequent appointment of a gay attorney to a city post.
The recent presidential election in Poland produced no clear-cut winner, so a runoff will be held on October 23rd. The contest will pit the homophobic conservative mayor of Warsaw, Lech Kaczynski, who fought against Poland's first-ever gay and lesbian pride march, against moderate Donald Tusk, who unexpectedly outpolled Kaczynski in the earlier round. Kaczynski's party, Law and Justice, recently won control of parliament, and his party's new prime minister, Kazimierz Marcinkiewicz, has advocated rolling back recent legal protections for gays and lesbians, putting the country on a likely collision course with the European Union, which Poland joined only last year.
A Turkish judge has rebuffed a government official's attempt to shut down that country's only LGBT civil rights organization, a decision hailed as the first legal victory for gays and lesbians since Turkey applied for entry into the European Union. Chaos, the Gay and Lesbian Cultural Research and Solidarity Organization, was being threatened with closure by the deputy governor of the capital city of Ankara on grounds that Chaos is breaking the nation's immorality laws. Although the group has been around since 1994, it only recently sought official registration as a non-governmental agency, normally a mere formality. In denying the deputy governor's request for a ban on the group, Judge Kursat Kairal noted that the American Psychiatric Association does not consider homosexuality a disorder, and that the words gay and lesbian are widely used in daily life and scientific research. While homosexuality is not illegal in Turkey, the government has steadfastly refused to grant specific rights to gays and lesbians. The country has been under increasing pressure to offer protections for LGBT citizens as it pursues full membership in the European Union.
Hong Kong's government has appealed an August 24th ruling striking down a law that punishes gay male sex with life in prison when one or both partners are under 21 years old. Heterosexual sex has no such penalty. Judge Michael Hartman called the statute a grave and arbitrary interference with the right of gay men to self-autonomy in the most intimate aspects of their private lives. The government claims its appeal is based on significant public concern.
Meanwhile, thousands participated in Taiwan's third annual Pride Parade early this month in the capital city of Taipei. Pride spokesperson Ashley Wu said that although Taiwan's society has become more liberal in recent years, there are still some politicians that make comments discriminating against homosexuals. He also asserted that gays and lesbians face bias in the country's legal system. Said another Pride participant, "We want society to treat us like normal human beings and not see us like aliens or sick people."
More than 1,000 Croatian gay and lesbian civil rights supporters signed their first names to a newspaper ad calling for tolerance and understanding in recent editions of the heavily Catholic country's two largest circulation dailies and in several magazines. Headlined, "We don't want to hide anymore," the ad also included the ages and sexual orientations of the signatories. In it, they assert, "Little divides us and a lot unites us. Reconsider your prejudice." Dorino Manzin, head of the LGBT group Iskorak, told the BBC, "Even though it's just a symbolic coming out, without full names, this is a good reflection that gays in Croatia are gathering courage to fully expose themselves and that society is growing more tolerant."
And finally, despite severe legal and societal pressures against them, gay and lesbian Arabs in the Middle East are also organizing. In Beirut, Lebanon, in May, the International Day Against Homophobia was observed by the rights group Helem, which marked the occasion with the gathering of about 200 people, both lesbi, gay, and heterosexual supporters, at a local hotel. The group screened the film I Exist, a documentary on homosexuals in the Middle East, and distributed buttons and pamphlets with the slogan, "You drink coffee, I prefer tea, does that mean one of us is abnormal?" Helem also recently launched what is believed to be the first magazine for gays and lesbians in the region, Bara, which in Arabic means out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 15th, 2005. Written this week by Rick Watts and Lucia Chappell and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This is Queer Voices.
And now we're going to be talking with Danielle Sampay, the executive director of the Lazarus House. And Danielle was our guest a couple of months ago. And why don't you just refresh our memories about what the Lazarus House is all about?
Well, thank you for having me back and giving us another opportunity to talk about the Lazarus House on the air. The Lazarus House is a nonprofit wellness center that works with people who have disease-related wasting conditions. Most of our clients are HIV positive, but we work with other chronic illnesses like cancer, lupus. It's at the discretion of their physician. Our clients don't actually have to be wasting. They just have to have a disease that can or is causing wasting. So we do a proactive approach too. And basically what we do is we provide a comfortable venue for them to exercise in. The Lazarus House is a home. It is an old Victorian house that's very, very comfortable. It's not 24 hours or ballets. It's not a threatening environment.
You mean we don't have to put on a little leotards and tights?
That's if you look good in it, you're welcome to do it. No, but we just try to make it really comfortable environment. And when you're walking into a home, it's just not as threatening as when you're walking into a gym. And then they work with trainers, certified trainers that have their program written specific for each client to help them increase their lean body mass, lose fat, increase endurance, and our ultimate goal is to increase the quality of life.
Mm-hmm. And so they get an exercise program?
That's right. Mm-hmm. They come to us three times a week. We exercise them. They work with a trainer. They'll probably have a partner if they're lucky. And three times a week, 12 times a month, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. For an hour, we exercise them.
And the trainers donate their time?
The trainers right now are staff. For the first year in operation, everybody donated their time. Being a nonprofit, we lived up to that term. We were definitely a nonprofit, and I have a great, great staff working with me and people who are compassionate and care enough to donate a year, basically, of their time.
And so that's one reason you have to do fundraising.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why I'm here today to talk about the Lazarus House's haunted house. It's actually a party that we have for Halloween. We started off kind of small two Halloweens ago, just as kind of a thank you to all the people who had been supporting us. We had a little party, and so many people showed up, and it's amazing how many people like to dress up for Halloween.
And not in this community.
Right.
Sometimes they do it when it's not even Halloween.
Right. You're 9 months early. Well, so last year it got bigger and better, and so this year we've just decided to go ahead and advertise it. We haunt the house. We get it all decorated. There's fog machine, spider webs, just a lot of fun. And
there's haunted treadmill.
That's horror in itself.
I think I've been on one of those.
20-pound dumbbell. No, but... we have
the torture chamber, literally.
Some of our trainers are, they're haunted in themselves. So.
Yeah, I've heard they can be, pretty taskmasters, so to speak. Maybe you're going to dress up like a dominatrix.
Oh, who told?
It just seemed to be apropos.
All right, it's a come-as-I-am party for me. So, yes, actually, I am going to be dressed up as a dominatrix.
I knew it. I was channeling. There, I was getting the seance. It came to me.
You caught my vibe.
Yeah, it did indeed. And so people are encouraged to come in costume, but they don't have to.
Right. The costumes are optional. We will have prizes for best costumes.
Is clothing optional?
No. Oh. Clothing is mandatory.
Glenn would have been there then if it was clothing optional.
I've seen some of those costumes.
Uh-huh.
But it's $10 donation at the door, and it... there's an open bar, there's music, and the backyard will have a big tent set up with a disco ball and a dance floor.
When is it?
It is October 29th. That's a good thing to know. October 29th, 8 o'clock is when we kick the party off.
And so that's the same, it's the evening of the day of the Women's Festival that was rescheduled.
Right.
So
right.
If you're going to be downtown anyway, you might as well head over to the Lazarus House and give the address.
We're at 4106 Austin Street.
What's the nearest cross street?
West Alabama. We're in Midtown. It's not that difficult to find us. We're just past San Jacinto if you were going down West Alabama.
And it won't be hard to spot which house is the right one, because you'll know.
Yes.
The one that looks haunted.
The haunted one that's partying.
Yeah, that will be the place to be. And tell me what the term, the Lazarus House, where does that come from?
Well, basically, the Lazarus House was a God-given name. It's very appropriate for the type of people that we're working with. Lazarus is mentioned twice in the Bible. One time, Lazarus was a friend of Jesus, and he died too early, and Jesus told him to arise. And we have a lot of people that, they have difficult times. Their medical conditions are just wearing them down, and there are things that we can do to help them increase their energy and live. And so basically, we're encouraging that part. And the other time that Lazarus was mentioned in the Bible was Lazarus was a poor man who was ignored by the rich, and he sat outside. He was a man whose the dogs licked his sores, and he died because he was ignored by the rich. And we're saying, although we're not rich, we're not going to ignore the poor. And we know with the clients that we're working with and their chronic illness that they're financially struggle. So we made a nonprofit for them where they pay a very small fee for a month. They pay $100 basically a month, and that's $8.33 a session that equates to. And there's no facility costs. The program's specifically written for them.
So do you have to have like a prescription from your doctor in order to come, or you can just self-refer and say, I have fibromyalgia and I feel like I need this service, I would be able to?
First thing we would do is invite you to come visit us and take a look, make sure it's a comfortable thing for you and it's what you're looking for, and then we request that you get a release, not a prescription because we're non-clinical, but a release from your physician, and in that release, your doctor will make that diagnosis of cachexia, and that's basically what we work with. Cachexia is the big medical term for disease-related wasting. And remember, you don't have to have cachexia. You just have to have a condition that can cause it.
Uh-huh. And how do people get in touch with you?
You can call me at 713 713- 526-5071. And we just invite everybody to come out and take a look at us. We're very unique. You're not going to find anything like us anywhere.
So if you want to have a... Now, how does the flyer say it? This party won't suck.
That's what we tell everybody. And remember, this party won't suck. Yeah. Last year, I had to tell people to leave, to get off the porch. It was so late. Everybody was going to use it as a kickoff party, and they loved it. They stayed forever. I had to turn off and on the lights at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And they thought that was just spooks.
Yeah, they're like, party.
On the flyer that you get over the email, it's animated, and they have dancing skeletons and all, little bats flying around and spiders dropping down, and so it's really fun.
It's a lot of fun. You can see the Evite at our website, thelazarushouse.org, and look for the Halloween 2005.
Thelazarushouse.org.
Correct.
And look for the Halloween...
Evite.
Okay. Well, there you have it. And thank you again, Danielle,
thank
for being
you.
With us on Queer Voices.
Mobile and silent, I wanted to call you to tell you I've been lying. You were right to be afraid. All the way I live my life, I let myself feel only one day in a year. That day was yesterday, last night, and I'm tempted to let myself run again the way I always let myself run away from the pain that comes from looking in the mirror, claiming my emotions as my own. No longer silent, I'm making a vow today as I watch the sun rising. A vow to honesty with myself. Cause if I'm honest with myself, might be willing to be honest with the ones I love. And I'll never need to run again the way I always let myself run away from the pain that comes from looking in the mirror, blaming my emotions as my own. Cause if I'm silent in fear of saying the wrong thing, I'll never say anything real. And if I run in fear of anger, I'll never really heal. Oh. Immobile and silent, I wanted to call you. Tell you I've been lying, you were right to be afraid. All the way I live my life, I let myself feel only one day in a year. That day was yesterday, last night, but I don't think I'll let myself run again the way I always let myself run away from the pain that comes from looking in the mirror, claiming my emotions as my own.
That was As My Own by Susan Bush from her self-titled CD.
When Canada became the fourth country in the world to legalize same-gender marriage, it also became the first to allow queer couples from other countries to legally marry there. That opened the door to couples from around the world traveling to Canada to get married and then returning home to fight for legal recognition of their relationships. One of the couples taking up that challenge is trying a different tactic and also staking their claim as the youngest Australian gay couple ever to be legally married. 24-year-old Australian marriage equality leader Luke Gahn tied the knot on September 2nd in Vancouver, British Columbia, with his partner of 5 years, 27-year-old Matthew Culleton, and with family and friends happily celebrating the occasion with them. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching spoke with Gahn about fighting for marriage equality in Australia from their current Canadian outpost.
We've been together for 5 years, and we'd joked about marriage, but it was never really a reality. So we never thought it, we sort of just put it back our minds. And
Luke Gahan is the founder of Australian Marriage Equality.
The whole marriage issue had sort of not really entered anyone's consciousness. And Matt and I were traveling about 12 months ago, and we came over to both Canada and the US and met people that had been married. And suddenly it hit us that this is such a fantastic opportunity. So we went home and began planning straight away to come back to get married. We were actually in the middle of sending out invitations when the marriage ban got passed in Australia. And then about less than a month later, the government was re-elected. And when that happened, a lot of our hopes were lost that the marriage ban was going to be annulled. And so we actually we looked into getting working visas in Canada, and so we decided to get the working holiday program. We've come here for 12 months.
Luke and his partner Matthew Culleton have been in Vancouver for 3 months now. They were married on September 2nd. But the government of Australia won't recognize their marriage back at home, and they've been told their options are limited when it comes to trying to fight the government's position.
Unfortunately, we looked at court challenges, and we were all told that, unfortunately, that there would be no way we could go through the courts because we don't have a Bill of Rights or Charter of Freedoms to actually fall back on. And we started then looking at the possibility of having same-sex marriage at a state level. We never have had marriages since probably about the early 1950s. It all became federal, so we haven't had state-based marriages. And it looks like due to a constitutional glitch, we might be able to get same-sex marriage at a state level. So there are bills before the Tasmanian Parliament, but it's unlikely that those will get passed anytime soon.
So Luke and Matthew have chosen to live in Canada for a year and fight their battle from a distance. Already, their story and the stories of dozens of other same-sex couples who have come here from Australia to marry has created a media profile for the issue back at home. Luke says that when the Australian government passed its same-sex marriage ban, there was little press coverage, and few Australians even knew what had happened. But when Luke and Matthew left the country, a large article in one of the main newspapers in Sydney alerted people to the ban and provided a human face to the issue of same-sex marriage. Still, it will likely be a long time before they change enough people's minds for same-sex marriage to become a reality in Australia.
Yeah, Australia's a very strange place, to say the least. We've had the same government now for 10 years, coming up to 10 years, and it's a conservative federal government, but every single state and territory now has, for the first time, a Labor government, which is our left-wing government. So it's a bit topsy-turvy. But the situation is that both the two major parties have not committed to same-sex marriage or any federal same-sex relationship recognition. It's a bit of a strange situation. We've never had a religious right like in the US. However, in the last 12 months, a new Christian lobby has been formed, and a Christian political party which managed to get one senator elected in Australia, who's already started campaigning to change abortion laws and calls same-sex marriage ban his number one success.
The campaign for same-sex marriage in Australia continues, however. Luke says their current strategy is to lobby state governments, who he feels are more sympathetic to the issues than the federal government. Many state governments already recognize same-sex couples as de facto spouses, with some, if not all, of the same rights that come with marriage. Luke also says that Canadians can play a role in helping end Australia's marriage ban.
I think it'd be a brilliant message that Canadians should actually get active and start contacting, you know, even the Australian High Commission or the Australian Tourist Bureau here in Canada and say, look, we're not coming to Australia now for a holiday, or, you know, we're not going to watch the Commonwealth Games next year in Melbourne because you're outlawing our marriages, and tell them how you feel about that. And even get your heterosexual married friends to write and say, look, it's not fair that you're recognising some of us in Canada as married and others that aren't, even as tourists in the country.
For This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching in Vancouver.
Between a man and
that wasn't the Chixie Dicks. That was the, it was the Chixie Dicks. I'm saying it wasn't the Dixie Chicks. It's so confusing. The song was called Marry Me from the Marry Me compilation. And in the studio now, we have
this is Queer Voices.
With us now, we've got some folks from Stages talking about their new play, which opens, this weekend. We have Rob Bundy and Kelly Stolt and Elena.
Elena Coates.
Coates, right.
Yeah.
I got two of the names right. Tell us about the play, guys. Who wants to start?
Well,
Rob, you go ahead.
Do I go ahead?
You go ahead.
The reason I got Alexa to go ahead is because I directed it. I've been in love with this play since 1998 when it won the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize, which is a prize for international playwright women who write in English. And it co-won with Kelly... Paula Vogel.
Oh, yeah.
Right. How I Learned to Drive. Yeah. And so, and it's.
Wow,
this is
that's
just,
impressive.
Yeah, no, this is a wonderful play. And it's. I just think it is one of the most insightful plays into women relationships, men relationships, and power. And it's all sort of couched in comedy. It's a really funny play about really serious issues. And it's great parts for two women. And I'm fortunate enough that here in Houston found the two perfect women for this part, for these parts.
Oh, go on.
Stop it. No, really.
So I guess what we're going to do is we're going to give away a little bit of a secret that in our marketing and all of the things that we've been talking about with this play, we have been very careful in holding that little card to our vest. But
and we haven't
even
mentioned the name of the play. That's how secretive we are.
Well, and you know what? And here's how secretive. The play's called Silence. Isn't that appropriate? But it's actually about young Prince Silence of Cumbria, and that's played by Kelly Stolte.
And Cumbria is right next to Moldova, right?
Exactly, right, yeah. And then and this takes place in 999, so it's just before the beginning of the second millennium. So there's all this fear about what's going to happen when the millennium shifts.
Well, that Y1K fever.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Y1K, exactly, exactly right. And and it's about an arranged marriage between young Prince Silence of Cumbria and Princess Yemma of Normandy, a very strong-willed princess who has sort of been banished from Normandy because she's so tough and strong. And there's a little bit of a secret that occurs on the wedding night, and that's our secret that we're going to actually talk about.
Right. Turns out Silence has been brought up as a boy, raised as a boy, told all her life that she was a boy. And on her wedding night, the mechanics just aren't working quite correctly. And under a little bit of investigation, we discover that Silence is actually a girl who's been raised with all the privilege of a young lord and learned how to fight and learned to rule her country. And discovering that she's actually a woman puts
on that night.
On the wedding night.
On the wedding night, which is a great, wonderful thing to do.
She had no concept that she's a woman.
No, had no idea.
And then her beloved, or I guess it's his betrothed, is female.
Right.
And also had no idea that she was getting married to anyone other than a prince.
Right.
Right, because he's only 14.
Oh.
He's only 14, so they're...
That's sick.
One would have reason to believe that... Silence perhaps wouldn't be as masculine or burly as you might expect from a warrior.
Right, but they figure out he'd grow up. And actually, arranged marriages that young between royal families was done very
right.
often.
Are both of them the same age?
No. Yemma is older.
Yemma's been around the block a couple times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She knows her way around, which she's actually the one who discovers that Silence is not a boy. And she explains to him, look, you don't have this, you don't have that.
But you
You're
do
a
have
girl.
These.
You have these, and right. you have this other thing, and it looks like me, and, you know,
and
we're both girls.
And she's disappointed.
We don't know.
Well, I would say she's a little bit surprised, but I think one of the things that we love most about the play that we've been talking about is how interesting the plot becomes when they make this discovery and how they use this discovery to help each other. Because they, instead of rejecting the relationship, which the political structure at the time and the religious structure at the time would both do, which they talk about, they realize what an advantage it could be to maintain this relationship. And I think they have a genuine affection for each other.
Absolutely. Hold that thought for a moment. You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT 90.1 in Houston.
And I guess there could be a problem in producing an heir.
That is a problem.
Well, it's a hitch,
But
that could be resolved other ways.
Right.
I see.
But as the play progresses, that doesn't become the major problem. The major problem is just to get them into a place where actually they can be safe. And how do they, you know, coexist in a society that is dominated by the whole phobia of women in power, and certainly. What had happened was that under the church and the King of England, these two women were married.
Yeah,
which is wrong from somebody's point of view way back then.
She didn't know that's all fit
well,
right
in then. Right, exactly.
Some things
exactly.
just don't change.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? After 1,000 years, we're still that scared.
Yeah.
1,006.
Yeah. That's frightening, isn't it?
So, you're Prince Silence?
I am. I'm Young Lord Prince Silence.
Yeah.
it's great. What was really fun was when Rob first talked to me about the show, and you know, I came into audition, but I was auditioning for the part of a boy.
A 14-year-old boy.
Which,
were you told that that's what it was? Did you know that it was a gender question mark thing going on?
No, I was told that's what it was. Rob just had me pretty much read the script, because there's really no way to describe the situation unless you're familiar with the story, which the script is great. I just loved it.
But you knew they were looking to cast a female in the role of the prince.
Right.
Kind of like a Peter Pan thing.
Yeah, very similar.
Very good. Yeah.
Very similar.
And she's very convincing. She's really great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Did you study a little bit? Did you watch some young men kind of pick up mannerisms?
Yes. I started a long time ago watching guys walk, because I noticed just in walking they carry themselves much differently than women, which... You know, it's easy to see a guy walking differently and carrying himself differently amongst men and amongst women, but to actually make your body do that wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. But, you know, you work with it.
Yeah, we have a movement consultant who's been helping us out a lot, Brian Burns, who's just been great. And there's lots of fight scenes. I mean, there's all kinds of fight scenes. Actually, both of them have fight scenes.
Mm-hmm. We both handle swords and weaponry and have capes.
Daggers and rings. Oh, it's wonderful. It.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Is there physical humor as well as mental?
There's a huge amount of physical humor.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's a really funny, rollicking play.
And there's some steamy scenes, too.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. There's some girl-on-girl action.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
In almost every way you can imagine, there's a little bit of steam.
I see. So our audience is so there. So it opens this weekend?
Yeah, it opens this Friday night, and then it runs to November 6th.
And we have performances Wednesday through Sunday. We have a Sunday matinee at 3. And our Wednesday, Thursday performances are 7:30 p.m. And our Friday, Saturday performances are 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm. And how many characters in all are in the play?
A total of 6.
And are there people playing multiple roles?
No, in this particular play, there are no people, and which is a big stage's tradition, kind of, it seems. Yeah. But no, in this one, it is not. Yeah.
And actually, if I could mention them, Elizabeth Bird plays Agnes, who is Yemma's... Lady in Waiting.
Right, who's very funny.
Rutherford Cravens plays Ethelred the Unready, the King of England, who actually is a historical character, and so is Yemma. Josh Morrison plays Edric, who is the King's soldier, and then David Wald plays Roger, a very humorous priest.
Yes, it's very funny.
It sounds like there's lots of opportunities for humor based on who knows what and who doesn't know what at what time.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
And how does Silence
initially respond to this knowledge?
Actually,
it's a funny scene.
Yeah, she almost goes. Rob and I talked about it. She almost goes through the phases of accepting and rejecting, like a death. You know, where there's bargaining with the heavenlies,
denial.
Going. Yeah,
denial,
there's severe denial. They told me I was a boy. I'm a boy. That has to be it. There's plea bargaining, and then there's just anger. Why didn't anybody tell me this? And finally, you know, you can't really deny something that big forever, and so there's an acceptance. But quite a bit goes on in just a few minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's big news.
Yeah.
And then immediately Yemma and Silence are confronted with knowing now what we know. What do we do next? Because, you know, the world's going to keep on going. There's still a king, and there's a priest, and there's Yemma's lady-in-waiting. There's a lot of people who still have relationships with these two characters and must be, you know, we have to hide the truth from them, or do we reveal it?
Mm-hmm. And what happens if you reveal it?
Mm-hmm.
And how can you use that for your own intentions?
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, because that's one of the things that Yemma discovers. She goes, well, how horrible. What happened if my mother did that to me, what you got done to you? And then she goes, oh, my God, I'd be Duke of Normandy.
Right.
That would be really pretty terrific.
Uh-huh.
And then I think that's what sort of inspires Yemma to say, why don't we try to hide this and see if we can actually become successful?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the sort of the epic journey begins.
Very clever premise.
It's a really terrific play.
A wonderfully written play.
Yeah.
I love it.
Written by an Irish woman, Moira Buffini. She lives in London, and just, I think, very, very poetically written. I mean, the way we say is it's William Shakespeare meets Monty Python.
Which that concept alone kind of...
Right. Exactly, because it's poetically written, but it's hilarious.
I got an email from the playwright. She talks about just the different myths and that they were ripe for rediscovering. She says the myth of the sold princess and the myth of the young man or woman trying desperately to discover what male and female means. So it's a really interesting exploration of expectations and definitions and potential.
I think it's funny with some meat to it.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
That's great.
Yeah,
it's
which
really
is what
great.
We love to do at stages.
Yeah. And all those questions of what exactly gender means and how it can play out in your life. I mean, as a feminist, we say this thing about it always starts with whether you get a blue blanket or a pink blanket.
Absolutely.
It can set the course of your life.
Which is why I gave my baby yellow.
I think reds and blues. I had boys, but reds, greens, you know, bright primary colors.
That's great.
And, of course, in Free to Be You and Me, the book that Marlo Thomas put together, and they used to run series of stories for children in Ms. Magazine, they had the story of Baby X, and Baby X was brought up that way.
They
wore little overalls, and there was never anything, you know, it's like Baby X can decide what Baby X wants to do and how Baby X wants to be when Baby X grows up, but you don't know whether Baby X is male or female. So it is kind of a continuation of that idea and what possibilities there may be, as well as what kind of restrictions are on people. I mean, there's certain things that, as a young man, that people expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is going to happen.
Right. There's also there's a funny moment where Silence, in kind of plea bargaining with the gods, saying, please don't let me be a woman. She says, don't let me be female. Women have shrunken souls.
Because that's what the priest has taught her.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
So there's not just, you know, political implications, but just societal things. This is what a woman is. A woman is not a good creature. She has a shrunken soul. She doesn't know what she's doing.
There's also a really interesting leitmotif that goes on about religion, because Silence comes from the north of England, in Cumbria, where there are a lot of Vikings, and he's part Viking. And so they're afraid that he's a pagan.
I can see that from looking at.
Yeah. She does look like a Viking.
Right.
But they want to make sure that this alliance is sacrosanct, I guess. Is that the right word?
Yeah,
and so that's where the priest comes in, because the priest has been sent to educate the young lord to make sure that everything's on the up and up. And so as we go through the story and the journey that they go on, he's explaining all of these religious ideas to Silence, and to him they're brand new, and it's just a really fresh and funny way of looking at certain ideas that get filtered through that particular avenue. Okay.
Well, I always say the Irish got messed up when St. Patrick went there. Being the pagan that I am. So, at Stages, and how do people... Tell people where Stages
where
is.
Where is Stages?
Where is it?
Stages is at Allen Parkway and Waugh. It's where the old Children's Museum used to be 10 years ago. And it's right across the street from where Guava Lamp just opened.
Yes. Yes.
And
Guava Lamp is on the corner, and the fountain that's adjacent to Stages is right across the street. So
it's a little different than how it used to be. I mean, well, you used to pull up Stages, and there was a parking lot, and
there's a parking lot, and you could see it from Waugh, but you can't anymore because of that strip center.
And you must always say Waugh Drive.
Why is there a Waugh Street?
You say Waugh Drive because just saying Waugh.
Oh, no one knows what it is.
It's peculiar.
Right, right. Waugh Drive.
And then to get in touch, to get tickets. And
we have a great website with lots of information, www.stagestheater.com. And theater is spelled with an R-E on the end.
The correct way.
Thank you. And then if you'd like to talk to our spectacular box office staff, you can call them at 713-527-0123. And they are fabulous.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yay.
Queer Voices.
By Mark Weigel, and before that we heard transgendered artist Vicky DeSalle doing Let the Good Times Roll.
You're listening
to Queer Voices.
Queer Voices.
Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
And you know what? It was a good day 4 years ago today because our guest, Pat Gandy, met her true love, Lucy Watson, and they're celebrating the 4th anniversary.
That's
very exciting.
Yes.
But that's not why you're here.
I'm not, yes, because she said, hurry up out there, get there on time. But no, she didn't either. Yes, it's 4 years, and 4 very nice years, and we've worked together on LHI all 4 of those years.
Well, and LHI is what?
LHI is the Lesbian Health Initiative. It's the oldest lesbian health organization that has continuously operated in Houston. We've been in business, so to speak, since 1980...
Whatever.
Eight or something like that. It was started then, and we're still in operation and never skipped a year.
Well, what is going on?
Well, we're going to have
what are you here pushing?
I'm pushing.
What kind of propaganda?
This is not just a social call.
No, it's not. It's the Rainbow Health Fair. Well, you know, it's Rainbow Health Fair in June for Pride, and it's Rainbow Health Fair in November, and it's on November the 5th. Saturday, November the 5th, 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. And LHI has a new phone number, by the way, for those that still have an old phone number. We had to get a new one for reasons that's too long to explain here. 713-426-3356. And we give mammograms to women who have no insurance, or insurance doesn't cover, the deductible's too big. And actually,
you have the MD Anderson mobile unit that comes to the site.
Comes to the Montrose Clinic. The Montrose Clinic gives us their facilities on these two Saturdays every year, and we get the MD Anderson mobile mammography unit, and they come out, and they're the ones that administer those. And if we have all the mammogram slots filled, which we do, by the way.
Already
28 slots are filled.
Wow.
But never fear. Out there, if we have vouchers to give you, if you'll show up at the health fair and need a mammogram, if you'll come to the health fair on Saturday, November the 5th at the Montrose Clinic, we'll give you a voucher to the Rose, which is a fine organization.
And that does a low-cost mammograms to those that need them. And
yeah,
for those that have insurance and can afford them, they'll charge full price.
But we give vouchers. We pay for their mammogram at the Rose. The Rose has a sliding scale.
Mm-hmm.
If people are really destitute, they'll do it for nothing. They'll mm-hmm. find a way, and they're really a good organization that caters to the entire female community, whereas we target lesbians and transgenders and gay men if they feel like they need a mammogram, but none of them have applied yet. Mm-hmm. Although
men can get breast cancer.
Yes, hey guys out there, listen up.
If maybe they've had a history of a male in their family having breast cancer, or if they feel something and want to have it checked out.
If they have insurance, go see your doctor like I do. Mm-hmm. If you don't,
I don't know what they call it, a release or a form from your doctor, an authorization from a doctor in order to get the mammogram?
No. You call Lucy Watson, who's our president, at this number, 713-426-3356. And if you don't have she does an interview for each person that gets a mammogram from the mobile mammography unit from MD Anderson. They have a form that she has to ask them a lot of questions. And if they don't have their own personal doctor, then the doctor at the Montrose Clinic is assigned. And then the mammogram is sent to either their doctor or to the Montrose Clinic. And that's how they get the results. And we're there if there's a follow-up needed. We follow up, too. I mean, you're just not left out there in the lurch. This organization is on the ball.
And mammograms should begin at age 40 and be done annually every year thereafter. And, of course, we should be doing our monthly self-exam.
Yes.
And a yearly exam by a health care practitioner. Now, is there someone at the health fair that does those?
Yes. We're going to do at the Montrose Clinic on that day. We have lots of other services, which are not only the mammograms in the mobile unit, but we have cholesterol checks, blood pressure and blood glucose checks, and breast exams and pap smears and pelvic exams by doctors who have volunteered.
Nancy Ford volunteered to do the breast exams, but we told her no.
Well, she just doesn't
have a
degree.
She's not a doctor.
These people
she's
come.
She's experienced, but she's not a doctor.
That's what I keep telling her.
They won't let any of us like that do that. They come from the medical center, and they're usually people who are working, they're doctors already, but they're getting their practical experience. But and some of them are you know, like some of our local physicians,
full-fledged who volunteer
their time. But they have an adequate number there, and you know, the pap smears and the pelvic exams, and we also on that day, women can get HIV and STD testing, and that's really important. for some folks to get also, if they're sexually active, and it's just a wise thing to do. We have osteoporosis screening. We have other health education activities. And we have a nurse educator that helps explain if your blood pressure is up so much. She helps tell you, you know, here, read this, and this tells you how to get down, how to get it down.
Now, and at other fairs, you've had community groups that have had little booths or
yes.
tables set up with information. Is that going to be part of this fair?
Yeah, we'll have some of that. We used to charge people for a table. We don't anymore. We just tell them to come on because we have so many people there. We just don't need. That's just another thing to fool with that we really don't need to do. We just invite people to bring their wares.
And now, I need to remind people that if they want to have the glucose testing, they need to come early before they have anything to eat.
That's right. That's a very good thing to remember.
Because I went last time and I had, I don't know, a bagel or something.
Oh, dear, yes. Yeah. Don't eat anything.
And get that done first, and then go through. You can go through. They I think, have a little check-off thing.
Sure.
And they give you the results.
Right.
So if there is something that has a problem, you can then maybe follow up on it with...
Right.
some other healthcare practitioner.
Yes, and we're having an oral cancer screening this time too. Dr. Carol Alvarado, a dentist, is volunteering her time to do oral cancer screening. Just look in the mouth, you know. Look in your mouth. Let's see.
what's going on in there.
You know.
And of course, that would be a concern, particularly for someone who might be a smoker.
Oh, yes, particularly.
Yes.
Yes.
And so everything is free, although you do receive funding from community groups and still from Susan G. Komen Foundation?
No, we haven't applied for another. We got one grant from the Susan Komen Foundation, and we had somebody at that time that was qualified to administer that all the bookwork that goes with that.
So your support now comes from
mostly local groups and individual.
Right.
We get money from the Houston Black Tie, from Kindred Spirits, from the Hollyfield Foundation, from the Stephen Kellett Foundation, from the Magnolia Christmas Party, from the Crew of Olympus, and we're gonna have. TGRA is going to be a contributor this year.
That's the Texas Gay Rodeo Association.
Yes.
See, so it comes around. You know, just like earlier we were talking about how lesbians came forward during the mm-hmm. AIDS crisis. Well, some of these groups that have been traditionally gay male bastions are now coming forward and helping in projects that are mainly lesbian identifying.
Yes, we would like, in addition to these groups, we have individual donors, and also Dr. Isabel Martinez, a physician out in the Katy area, is a big supporter of lesbian health initiative. She's with Blue Mesa Medical Associates. I wanted to say this too, that I think it's very important right now in this period of time, and has been for a little while, for not only our organization to be supported, but any other health organization, the health organizations that support
community.
The gay community and the lesbian community both, people should think and give as much as they possibly can to all of them.
So that's like
it's
the AIDS Foundation, Houston, the Montrose Clinic,
yes.
the Montrose Counseling Center, because...
Yes, you know... For LHI, for example, we haven't found a single other organization exactly like this anywhere else in the United States. Of course, some states have better health care than Texas.
Yeah.
But still, even in yeah. the so-called heartland of America, there is no such thing as LHI.
Mm.
And we have Sisters is a good organization, and Sisters
provides care teams for women with chronic
yes.
illnesses or maybe after hospital care, and
right.
they're very important.
Yeah, it's totally different. They have a
right.
totally different mission than us.
But
so
still,
you know, we're both, and a lot of them volunteer for our activities, and we volunteer for theirs, and we really hope that everybody will think about giving to all of these health organizations. It's really needed in our community now. We have to take care of our own.
Well, one way for folks to support the Lesbian Health Initiative is in February. There's an annual Valentine's Day event, and I know that's in the works for this coming February. We won't tell them what yet, but give the website and the contact number again for folks that want to find out more about the Rainbow Health Fair on November 5th.
Okay, the website is www. I don't think you have to use that anymore. LHI Houston. All one thing. LHIHouston.org. LHIHouston.org. Or email us at LHI@LHIHouston.org. Or call 713-426-3356. We have a newsletter. We'll be happy to send it to you and put you on our mailing list. We have over 850 women on it now. We'll be happy to add another 500 or 800 or 1,000. Just send us the info and we'll get it to you.
Well, thanks for being with us on Queer Voices, Pat Gandy. And Lucy, you get to feeling better real soon. You're listening to Queer Voices.
It's not your typical biopic. Capote covers just one 5.5-year slice of Truman Capote's life, that pivotal period during which he researched and wrote his groundbreaking 1966 classic, In Cold Blood, a book that changed journalism forever. Oscar buzz is already growing for Philip Seymour Hoffman's haunting performance in the title role. In fact, says This Way Out media mogul Steve Pride, Hoffman does such an astounding job, it almost overshadows the other joys of the film. Catherine Keener's nuanced performance as Capote's friend and To Kill a Mockingbird author Harper Lee, TV actor turned writer Dan Futterman's intelligent script, and Bennett Miller's lyrical direction. Pride talks with star Hoffman about making Capote and shares some clips from what he calls an extraordinary film about an extraordinary but troubled gay man.
On the night of November 14th, two men broke into a quiet farmhouse in Kansas and murdered an entire family. And why did they do that? Two worlds exist in this country, the quiet conservative life and the life of those two men with the underbelly, the criminally violent. And those worlds converged that bloody night.
In this dazzling film, Philip Seymour Hoffman is amazing in the title role. But the prolific character actor does not immediately spring to mind when you think of Truman Capote. And he agrees.
They came to my house with the script. Danny and Bennett, who I've known since I was in high school. I didn't go to high school with them, but I met them in the summer program then. And before that time, I'd never thought about it at all. I mean, literally, I probably was thinking about napping or something. And they came to my house and said, "Hey, we have a script. Do you want to play Truman Capote?" And I was like, I thought, first of all, that's absurd. And it really was. It was kind of like, well, that doesn't really. I mean, that was my reaction. It wasn't like, oh, yay, I get to, you know. It was like, what do you mean? You know, because of my image of Truman Capote in my head didn't really fit me.
Like many of us, Hoffman's image of Truman Capote was based on his latter years, long after the writing stopped and he slid into self-parody on the talk show circuit.
Dick Cavett, Johnny Carson, I watched these when I was a child, I'm sure everyone else did. I didn't immediately jump to that image of Truman and me going together. It just didn't, it wasn't the first thing that made me go like, oh, yeah, we're like brothers.
Yeah, I've decided on a title for my book. I think you'll like it. It's very masculine. It's In Cold Blood. Isn't that good?
I was aware of what he had written, what he was famous for, but this is the journey, right? So that's what I'm aware of at first, is that whole character, that whole personality, that raconteur that entertained us and, you know, made us unnerved and you know, the self-destructive side, the part of his life. And, so when I read the screenplay, that was when I was like, oh. And then I read the biography, which was, if you haven't read it, read it. It's a great read. I mean, it's kind of addictive. And I remember I couldn't put it down. It's very long, and you just can't stop reading it. And then I started to see what they were getting at. Do you know what I mean? And I started saying, oh, okay, I see maybe why. Maybe they're asking me. And But still, I was petrified of having to do all the work that it would take to play him, because it was still such a difference, such a kind of a chasm between us in many ways.
At the heart of this film is the relationship that formed between Truman Capote and one of the killers, Perry Smith.
Thank you. It is as much for me as for anyone. I couldn't bear the thought of losing you so soon.
We're going to be able to use your book for our case. You're right. We never got to raise an insanity plea. You wrote how terrible the lawyers was.
I haven't written a word yet.
What have you been doing?
Research. Talking to you.
Of course, I think he was obsessed. I think he was fascinated. It was the beginning of the end. You know, he saw Perry Smith and he was like, oh my God, who is that? And it's like, for all the reasons, so like, you know, attraction and love are of course going to come out of that, or part of that, byproduct of that. But like Bennett said, I don't know if you were at the press conference, what Bennett said about the idea of them, you know, that it was some sexual relationship, I think is... To me, my answer to that is kind of like, I don't think it happened. But even if it did, it's not something that I think is really important. I think it would dilute the actual real tragedy that happened here, which happens to do with the end of a writer's life, you know. So yes, but of course, I think he wanted to eat him. I mean, I think it was like, if he could have just digested this guy, he would have.
The film presents Truman Capote, warts and all. He bonded with the killers. He helped them find lawyers for their appeals and visited them in prison. But he needed their execution. He needed an ending for his book. And this conflict is so brilliantly portrayed by Philip Seymour Hoffman that it made my skin crawl.
They only exacerbate the problem. They only heighten or intensify it. Maybe we can start our
own program. I know what exacerbate means.
Okay.
There's not a word or a sentence or a concept that you can illuminate for me. There is one singular reason I keep coming here.
Truman.
November 14th, 1959. 3 years ago. 3 years. Mm-hmm. And that's all I want to hear from you.
Truman Capote was a raconteur. He was the life of the party. And as portrayed in the film, this seems almost as important to him as his work. As his writing.
What life was he choosing? I think he was choosing acceptance.
Actor Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And what part of society, that what meaning, like he liked to hang out with a high society, but some of the men he ended up dating were from a whole different class level. You know what I mean? It's like where he wanted acceptance was really anybody's guess. You know what I mean? And I stand by that. I don't think he was just looking for one thing. I think he was looking for something from a lot of different people in a lot of different areas, because I think his need was so great, you know. I'm wary of saying that Truman Capote sat there and was like consciously going, I think he wanted to be a part of that world. He became a part of it. I think he wanted also to be a part of this world, and he became a part of it. I think when he chose to be a part of something, he made it happen.
Maybe since I was a child, folks have thought they had me picked because of the way I talk. They're always wrong.
My job wasn't to do a Saturday Night Live sketch or a caricature. My job was to tell a story. In a very honest human way. My job was first and foremost to tell a story. My job, even the primary aspect, wasn't even to play him correctly, was to tell this story. And one of the aspects and givens to tell this story was to get a sense of him as honestly and as soulfully as possible, so that you would forget about the image that I had when they offered me the role. Do you see what I'm saying? You would forget the raconteur personality, talk show, Saturday Night Live sketch guy. You would see the prolific, intelligent, witty, sharp, ambitious, duplicitous writer of a generation. But I needed to embody that thing, and that's what made me want to do it, because I said, if you're telling that story, I want to be a part of it.
Prior to the release of In Cold Blood, Truman Capote was a prolific writer. His work included the lyrics for the Broadway musical House of Flowers, the screenplay for the Humphrey Bogart film Beat the Devil, the novel Other Voices, Other Rooms, and the novella Breakfast at Tiffany's, which was turned into a classic film with Audrey Hepburn. After the publication of In Cold Blood, perhaps his greatest work, Capote never finished another book or play. This has been a conversation with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Capote was directed by Bennett Miller, based on the book Capote by Gerald Clark, with a screenplay by Judging Amy actor Dan Futterman. It also stars Catherine Kinnear and is a Sony Pictures Classic release. For more information on Capote or other films of gay interest, visit PrideOnScreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Sherry Lund, John Beaupre, Lucia Chappelle, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Heather Kitching, and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can help keep this program on the air. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KPOV Bend, Oregon, WOJX Northampton, Massachusetts, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, last week I wasn't here, and I understand there was a fabulous interview talking about coming out. But we seem to have missed talking about transgender coming out. And Jennifer Renee is here to fill us in on some of those stories, or her story in particular.
Well, that's the only one I know, Jack.
Well, I'm sure you know other ones, but that's the only one you went through.
Well, that
yourself.
Would only be hearsay.
Right.
And we can't have any of that.
No.
Oh.
Well, tell us a little bit about what it was like dealing with some of the issues that you have dealt with.
Well, I think to do justice to it, I really need to start from the beginning, and I'll make it clear.
Good place to start.
Hey, it always is. I think I have the first recollection of realizing that I may have been born a boy, but I had other feelings about the time I was 4, 5, 6 years old, right in there, when my family reinforced the famous phrase, you know, little boys don't do that. And I had two sisters, and so I chose to play with them and do the little girl things, and it was reinforced that wasn't what I was supposed to be doing.
And a lot of gay guys probably did the same thing, or, you know, lesbian girls.
I could be.
I go with Vicky Shaw thing. I mean, she does a poll of how many of us played with Barbies, and you know, at least 50% of the hands go up, so...
Does it count if you dressed up G.I. Joe in girls' clothes?
Probably, yes.
Okay, just checking. But from there, you know, I did all of the normal boy things you do. In school, I look at it as I was trying to cover up, keep people from realizing what I was. Even though it may not have been as apparent to them, it was to me, because I was always thinking and having to translate, thinking as a girl and translating into guy, so that I could, keep hidden. Did all the things guys do. I played football, ran track, did well at it.
And still has great legs.
Oh, thank you. But there was always that feeling inside that there was something different, that it wasn't who I was. Back in the early 70s is the first time I realized that I was different, and it had a name.
How did that come to you? I mean, did you initially just think, oh, well, I must be gay?
Well, I true enough, I felt, oh my gosh, I must be gay, because that's the only thing I could compare it to, and the only thing that I could I knew of in my life experience at that time. But what happened was is that I made a trip to New Orleans, bless his heart, and went into a club, what was then called the Gunga Den, and the big sign said, "All our girls are boys," and my heart stopped. And I must have passed that place for an hour before I got up the courage to walk in and sit down in a dark corner and watch the show.
Up to that point, had you ever dressed in female clothing or done makeup?
Since I was 9 years old. My big experience was when I was 12, when my mother caught me in the bathroom with, since I had sisters, I had some of their clothes and some of her clothes and some of their makeup and some of her makeup. And, she exacted from me the infamous promise never to do this again. And of course, I knew in my heart of hearts I'm just not going to get caught again, and didn't, as far as she was concerned. But, yeah, from the time I was 9 years old, I was doing it, sneaking a little clothes, putting them on, getting that feel. I would had my own room in our home, and I would close the doors. I had privacy, and I could play and think and do the things I wanted to do that made me feel comfortable, you know. Once I left the confines of my bedroom, I had to put on an act. I had to be what my parents wanted me to be, what society expected me to be, and it was all based on my genitals.
Did you have to rein in female mannerisms?
Oh, yes. Yes. And that goes back to that original concept. At nine or so, the little boys are starting to be little boys, and I was still wanting to play with the little girls on the playgrounds. And
me too.
That was, yeah, well, no, I understand completely. But that was the whole problem. You know, I was not fitting in the way I was supposed to, and that was considered a problem, you know.
Did you dare ever even voice it to anyone else, a peer or a counselor, anyone?
No, but there's an interesting story. I was 9 years old, and I was on the playground, and we were talking, and somebody told me that if you could kiss your elbow, you would turn into the opposite sex. That night, I threw my shoulder out trying to kiss my elbow. Now, I don't know what that tells you, but that was an affirmation that I was not supposed to, or did not feel that I was supposed to be the person that everybody thought I was.
And, of course, you felt like you were a girl, but with all the messages that society gives about what it is to be female and all the negative connotations, I don't know if you heard the interview we had with the Stages folks earlier, but the play they have coming up deals with a young prince, at least a person brought up to be a young prince, who finds out on his wedding night that he's not a boy. And some of these same issues that we're talking about is, what is it like if you're conditioned in a certain way, and especially if what you're told is what you think you really are is something bad, not a good thing to be. You know, that in our society, it's better to be a boy than it is a girl.
Oh, absolutely. What I found, and going back to part of the answer to the other question too, was that I found myself in a situation where I always had to act. I was pretending to be something I wasn't. I would put on a performance of being the guy, you know, and after the big game, I would go out and drink beer with the best of them, and then go home and put on a nightie, you know. And that was I had to compartmentalize my life. I was living two distinctly different lives: one a private life as a woman, and the other a public life as a guy.
When did you come out to another person?
I came out to another person in, it would have been about 73, 74.
How was that? You know, as a friend?
Going back to my story of New Orleans, I took the time after. I sat there, and if you hang out in those clubs long enough, people just sort of notice you. And the MC at the time, her name was Candy, I remember her to this day, she came down and said, I've noticed you're here, you know, and I asked her to sit down, and I started asking her all of the questions. You know, what are you? You know, tell me about your life. And as she told me her life, I realized for the first time that there was someone else in the world that felt the same way I did. And it finally had a name. And no longer did I sort of think in the back of my mind that I was sick, there's something wrong with me, not everybody feels this way, I'm the only one that ever feels this way. I was no longer alone. And of course, she was supportive because she was in a process of transitioning.
Now, let's talk a little bit about transitioning, because there are men who are heterosexual, mm-hmm. who, you know, identify as heterosexual and have relationships with women, but cross-dress.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes go out in public dressed as female. And there's a range. That's why we've come to use this term transgendered, because it can be everything from that to someone who is a transvestite who routinely dresses up as a female and sometimes and historically has a connotation of doing it for sexual gratification.
Correct.
And then you have people who live as the other gender, may or may not take hormones, and then you have the people who transition all the way to transsexual, and of course, I guess the famous, best-known one was Christine Jurgensen, and when
and
I
Richards.
The tennis player, not the
No.
Jennifer, I'm curious, are drag queens considered part of the transgender community?
We include them in there. I think
people that just do it for performances.
Do it for performances. Mm-hmm. Because there's still that feeling inside that they're a little different. They're a little more feminine. You might call them effeminate. You know.
Some of them are pretty hot looking, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I agree with Anise Parker, because she says we as gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender are all gender transgressors. So we can all apply the term transgender if we choose to. So when I first met you, I didn't see you the first time as a woman. You came in to volunteer with Anise Parker's campaign, and of course you were very open about your status, but you still were, you know, wearing the clothes of a guy and like that. And since then, there's been a few changes, Jennifer.
Oh, thank you.
And they're all lovely. You were lovely as a guy, but I have to say, you're much lovelier now.
I remember that was so nice. The little story was that I would come in, and they never knew how I was going to show up to volunteer, whether I'd be as Jennifer or my male self, and so they made me a name tag, and on one side of the name was Jennifer, and you flipped it over, so that, you know, whatever, I was fitting, and that made, you know, it was good. It was the kind of acceptance that I needed. And that was a period of time where I was androgynous.
Mm-hmm.
Estrogen and female hormones had taken effect, that there was so many physical changes going on that physically I was neither male nor female, sort of that hinterground of both.
Here's a question I've never had a chance to ask. Are there divisions in the transgender community? Do they, the different classifications we've named, do they get along with each other? I've heard the M to F and the F to M, there may be some divisions there.
That
have you seen that? Male to female, female to male.
I think you have to take that individually. There are some. Mm-hmm. I'm part of the Transgender Unity Committee, and that it was formed years ago for the sole purpose of bringing all the different mm-hmm. segments of the transgender community together.
Yeah, but as we know historically, there are all kinds of gay men, all kinds of lesbians,
mm-hmm.
don't always get along for various reasons, and I've wondered, in the TG community, is this sort of thing too?
Yes, there is. It's not as great as it once was, because there's been a lot of work over the years, since I've been active in the community now for over 7 years, that to make sure that everyone is included, that there's no one left out. And the trans men are part of the ones that I want, you know, that we want to have as part of the community. It's very important that we're all stand together, including the
right,
gays and lesbians.
Right. And Jennifer, just to make sure, if someone was having the same kind of feeling, if they're having the same kind of feelings that you've described, or if they're transgendered and maybe have not found community, could you give us some contact information on what groups? I know there's quite a few groups, but the, like maybe a couple
kind
of main
ones. We want a couple of minutes, so just kind of narrow it down.
Okay, well, first of all, there's several good groups in here. One, you can contact, send us an email to the Transgendered Unity Committee, which is HTUC at Earthlink. Send us an email. We can send you some links to some other areas.
That's earthlink.net.
.net, excuse me. You can also, if you want to just contact me, you can just do Dear Jennifer, and Jennifer with one N, at AOL.com. There's also...
Is there a website?
Not for me.
Okay. We're working on that.
One of those
and
things.
And then TATS Houston, that's...
Yes.
What's TATS?
Texas Association for Transsexual Support.
Okay, so that would be one of the premier groups.
Yes, yes.
And
it
they
is.
Can be reached at tathouston@yahoogroups.com.
Correct.
So you can actually get on their Yahoo group. And
along with that, there are a lot of links to other groups, other support organizations, and for different parts of the state.
Thank you so much for being with us on Queer Voices.
And we'd like to thank all of our other guests this evening. We had talked about the subjects from the National Gay Lesbian Task Force.
With Matt Foreman and Danielle Sampay from the Lazarus House about their upcoming fundraiser for Halloween on the 29th.
And go see Silence. The stage is opening this weekend.
And Pat Gandy from Lesbian Health Initiative. We'll see you next week.
Been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org. Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Stands for New Orleans and Houston. We are a group of Houstonian area musicians and their friends reaching out to our brothers and sisters from the hurricane-stricken region of the Gulf Coast. We offer support to those musicians and their families who have been forced to leave their homes and their livelihoods and relocate to Houston. If you are or know a musician from that devastated area, please contact us. We can help. Our website is www.noah.com. NOAH Leans, LEANS.com. Or we can be reached by phone at 713-805-9118. NOAH. is an arm of the Musician Benevolent Association, a 501c3 nonprofit.
Dreams about being a part of a music business, surrounding yourself with rock stars? Well, make this dream a reality and become a volunteer for the Houston Women's Music Festival. Publicity, performer care, and video crew are just a few of the opportunities that wait. By volunteering, you'll gain free entry into the festival and a chance to get up close and personal with the performers. The Houston Women's Music Festival wants you. Just call 713-995-5251. Again, that number is 713-995-5251. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.